Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Well, it's Friday again, and this is me, Richard Martin, talking to you for the full hour, as they like to say on the radio and television. The date is Friday, the 21st of August, 2015, and the place is, of course, Penang. This month, the Empire State Manufacturing Report plunged nearly 19 percentage points to -14.92, well below the lowest Bloomberg EconoDay estimate of 3.0. As someone recently said, only weather forecasters and economists can ever be so wrong. There always seems to be perpetual optimism in expected conditions versus existing conditions. There is absolutely no reason to believe manufacturing will dramatically improve. Instead, there is every reason to think manufacturing will get worse, led by the automobile sector. Record or near-record car sales will not go on perpetually, yet the preponderance of economists seems to believe it will. When autos turn, the Fed will be in for a rude awakening. The government issued their monthly retail sales this past week, and four of the biggest department store chains in the country announced their quarterly results. The year-over-year retail sales increase of 2.4% is pitifully low in an economy that is supposedly in its sixth year of economic growth, with a reported unemployment rate of only 5.3%. If all of these jobs have been created, why aren't retail sales booming? The year-to-date numbers are even worse than the year-over-year numbers. With consumer spending accounting for 70% of GDP and real inflation running north of 5%, it's pretty clear most Americans are experiencing a recession, despite the propaganda data circulated by the government and the Fed. The only people not experiencing a recession are corporate executives enriching themselves through stock buybacks, Wall Street bankers using free Fed bucks while rigging the markets in their favor, politicians and government bureaucrats reaping their bribes from billionaire oligarchs and the media toadies who dispense the deep state-approved propaganda to keep the ignorant masses dazed, confused, and endlessly distracted by Cecil the Lion, Bruce or Caitlyn Jenner, take your pick, Ferguson, and blood coming out of whatever. You won't hear CNBC, Bloomberg, The Wall Street Journal, or any corporate mainstream media outlet reference the fact retail sales growth is at the exact same levels as when the recession hit in 2008 and 2001. Their job is to regurgitate the message of economic recovery and confidence in the future, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Retail sales are actually far worse than the 2.4% reported number. Excluding the subprime, debt-fueled auto sales, retail sales only grew by 1.3% in the last year. The automakers are practically giving vehicles away as their lots are stuffed with inventory. The length of auto loans and the average amount of auto loans are now at all-time highs. The percentage of subprime auto loans is surging to record levels as defaults begin to rise. The percentage of vehicles being leased is also at an all-time high. To call these auto sales strains credibility. These people are either perpetually renting their vehicles or just driving them until the repo man shows up. The relatively strong year-over-year furniture sales is also driven by the fact that you can finance the purchase at 0% interest for 7 years. All is well for the Ally Financial GE Capital and the myriad of fly-by-night subprime lenders until the recession arrives, unemployment soars, and defaults skyrocket. Then their bloated, debt-ridden balance sheets will explode in an avalanche of defaults. That's when they insist on another taxpayer bailout to save the financial system. The year-over-year crash in oil prices was supposed to result in a huge spending splurge by the masses, according to the media talking heads. You don't hear much about that storyline anymore. The talking heads are now worried that oil prices are too low. I guess the tens of thousands of layoffs in the oil industry and the obliteration of the Wall Street-financed shale oil fraud storyline is offsetting the $10 per week in gasoline savings for the average driver. At least restaurant and bar sales remain strong. It seems Americans have decided to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow they die. I do believe there is some truth to the saying in today's world. I think people are drowning their sorrows by drinking and eating. They're drastically reducing buying stuff they don't need with money they don't have. Spending their gas savings at a restaurant or bar is still doable. It honestly is an example of the death wish I tried so hard to stimulate into a discussion years ago on my third weekly show on PRN, which I abandoned along with the meetup group through lack of interest. With real median household incomes at 1989 levels, real employment north of 15%, a massive level of underemployment, young people unable to buy a home, saddled with $1 trillion of student loan debt, middle-aged parents struggling to take care of their aging parents, and struggling children and boomers who never saved for their retirement, the mood of the country is decidedly dark, and getting darker by the day. The rise of Trump and Sanders in the polls is an indication of this dissatisfaction with the existing social order. The part of the retail report flashing red is the sales of general merchandise stores and particularly department stores. This category includes the likes of Walmart, Target, Costco, Sears, Macy's, Kohl's, and JCPenney. General merchandise sales fell 0.5% in July, with department store sales dropping by 0.8%. Sales at these behemoth retailers have barely budged in the last year, with overall sales up a pathetic 0.3%. The dying department stores have seen their sales plummet by 2.7%. The talk of a retail revival is dead on arrival. Walmart and Target muddle on with lackluster results, while JCPenney and Sears continue their baton death march towards the retail graveyard. The false narrative of economic recovery can be blown to smithereens by the historical data on the Census Bureau website. Their time series data goes back to 1992. GDP has supposedly risen by 22% since 2007. General merchandise sales were $48.4 billion in July 2007. They were $56.1 billion in July 2015. That's a 15.9% increase in 8 years. Even the manipulated and massaged BLS CPI figure has increased 14.5% over this same time frame. That means that real retail sales at the nation's biggest retailers have been virtually flat for the last 8 years. Does that happen during an economic recovery? The department store data is almost beyond comprehension. July department store sales were the lowest in the history of the data series. Sales of $13.8 billion were 22% below the July 2007 level of $17.6 billion. They were 28% below the peak level of $19.2 billion in 1999. Real department store sales are 36.5% below where they were in 2007. And these fucking Wall Street shysters have had buy ratings on these stocks the whole way down. These worthless hucksters always remove their buy ratings one day before these dinosaur department stores declare bankruptcy. Excluding the debt-driven auto sales, real retail sales are flat at 2008 levels. The data from the Census Bureau has been more than confirmed by the absolutely atrocious financial results reported by Macy's, Kohl's, Sears, and JCPenney. Retailers do not report results this poor during economic recoveries. The results clearly point to an ongoing recession for the middle and lower classes who do the majority of working and spending in America. The rich continue to spend at exclusive boutiques and high-end retailers like Nordstrom's, but the average American is being sucked into the abyss by rising food prices, rent, home prices, tuition, and the Obamacare-driven health insurance and medical costs. With declining real wages, they have less and less disposable income to spend buying cheap Chinese crap at their local mall department stores. Here's a glimpse into the results of department store dinosaurs headed towards extinction. I want you to listen to this, even if you don't remember any of it. You have at least to have heard the grim facts. Even if they remain firmly locked up in your subconscious, they will be there, ladies and gentlemen. Count on it. Do not worry. That is why you are listening to the wake-up call. Let's start with Macy's. Overall sales fell 2.6%, while comparable store sales fell by 2.1%, as Macy's continues to close underperforming stores. Newsflash, there are many, many more stores to close. Profits crashed by 25.7% as gross margins declined and expenses rose. Cash flow from operations has declined by a staggering 46% in the first 6 months of this year. The bozos running this sinking retailer have mind-bogglingly burnt through $787 million of cash, while adding $452 million in long-term debt to buy back their own stock. Executive compensation is stock-based, so wasting close to $1.6 billion in the last year as sales and profits fall is considered prudent management by the CEO. Despite falling sales, the management of this sinking ship increased inventory by $200 million in the last year. This bodes well for margins in the second half of the year. The long-term future for this retailer gets bleaker by the day, as their long-term debt, pension liabilities, and other long-term obligations total $10.4 billion, while their declining stockholders' equity totals $4.8 billion. To show you how far Macy's has come in the last 9 years, just compare their results from the second quarter of 2006 to today. They registered sales of $6.0 billion versus $6.1 billion today. On a real inflation-adjusted basis, their sales have fallen by 16% over the nine-year period. They had profits of $317 million in 2006, 46% more than the $217 million in the second quarter of 2015. They had $13.6 billion of equity and $8.2 billion of long-term debt. And now for the best part. Despite generating 46% less income than they did 9 years ago, Macy's stock sits at $63 a share, while it traded at $36 a share in 2006. A company with declining revenue, declining profits, and a bleak future should not be sporting a P/E ratio of 16. When this recession really takes hold, their 2009 price level of $9 a share will be challenged on its way to Radio Shack land, $0 per share. So let's move on to Kohl's. Overall sales were up a pathetic 0.6% after last year's second quarter sales were lower than 2013. Comp store sales were up only 0.1% after being down 1.3% the previous year. Profits fell precipitously by a mere 44% versus the prior year, down by $102 million. Margins fell while expenses rose. In the lemming-like behaviour of corporate CEOs across the land, this struggling retailer thought it was a brilliant idea to go $330 billion further into debt, while buying back $543 million of stock in the first 6 months. While sales are essentially flat, the executives of this company ratcheted up their inventory levels by 9% in the last year. Flat sales growth and surging inventory levels leads to plunging margins and profits. I guess that's why many of you will have got a 30% off everything coupon in the mail last week. Cash from operations has crashed by 52% in the first 6 months. Would you think prudent executives would be using $500 million of cash to buy stock and boost their compensation packages? Another comparison to yesteryear provides some perspective on how well Kohl's is performing. During the second quarter of 2007, they generated $3.6 billion of sales and $269 million of profits. Their overall sales are up 19%, that's 3% on a real basis, even though they have increased their store base by 38%. Profits in 2015 were 50% lower than 2007. Sales per store are 14% lower today than they were in 2007. And even more worrisome for their long-term survival, inventory levels are up 59% compared to the 19% increase in sales. Again, the stock price peaked in 2007 at $76 and earlier this year reached a new all-time high of $79. Despite deteriorating financial conditions, poor management, plunging cash levels, and nothing on the horizon to portend a turnaround, the stock trades at a P/E ratio of 13. And now for our old friend Sears. Sears hasn't reported their second quarter results yet, but pre-announced that same-store sales crashed by 10.6% versus last year. They are truly a dead retailer walking. Eddie Lampert's real estate manoeuvres attempt to hide the coming bankruptcy from unsuspecting investors. They are nothing but smoke and mirrors perpetuated by Eddie and his Wall Street shyster bankers. Excluding his desperate real estate schemes, they will lose another $300 million. In the last 4 years during an economic recovery, Sears has seen its sales crater from $43 billion to $31 billion and still falling. They have managed to lose $7.4 billion in just over 4 years, and their stock still trades at $25 a share, proving there is a sucker born every minute. They continue to close hundreds of stores, and yet they still can't stop the hemorrhaging. The decade of using financial gimmicks rather than investing in its stores is coming home to roost for Eddie, the next Warren Buffett. Lampert. Of course, he will arrange matters in a way where he wins, while the stockholders lose when the bankruptcy papers are filed. The balance sheet is a disaster. They have generated a negative cash flow from operations of $1.4 billion in the last 12 months. They have burned through $556 million of cash. They have $8.4 billion of long-term debt and other liabilities with equity of negative $1.2 billion. Sears may easily be the worst-run business in America. Its chances of going bankrupt are 100%, but the Wall Street hype machine has its stock price at $25 a share, 20% higher than it was in late 2008. For some perspective, Sears' second quarter 2008 revenues totaled $11.8 billion, and they made a $65 million profit. Sales in the second quarter of 2015 will be approximately $6 billion, with a loss of at least $300 million. Of course their stock should be higher. Yeah, right. How about J.C. Penney? I found it humorous to see the Wall Street hucksters and their mainstream media mouthpieces cheering on the J.C. Penney second quarter results as better than expected and proof they have turned the corner. Their overall sales went up by 2.7%, and comp store sales went up by 4.1% as they continue to close stores. For some perspective on this tremendous sales gain to $2.9 billion, their sales in the second quarter of 2009 were $3.9 billion. When your sales are still 26 below where they were 6 years ago, maybe you shouldn't be crowing too much. It seems Wall Street and the mainstream media didn't really want to focus on the only thing that matters, profits. They lost another $138 million, and they've racked up $305 million of losses so far this year. They've lost money for 13 consecutive quarters. That is no easy feat. They have managed to lose $3.6 billion in the last 4.5 years while driving their annual sales from $18 billion to $12 billion. Even if their balance sheet isn't as horrific as Sears, it's nothing to write home about. They have $6.2 billion of long-term debt and other liabilities, supported by a mere $1.6 billion of equity. Back in 2011, they had $5.5 billion of equity to support $4.9 billion of long-term liabilities. The deterioration of this once proud retailer is clear to anyone with two eyes and a brain. So that eliminates all CNBC pundits and guests. Wall Street pumped the stock 5% higher last Friday to celebrate their $138 million loss. This company is on track to lose $500 million and has seen its stock price rise 32% this year on hopes and dreams. Now listen to this, ladies and gentlemen, and listen well. Wall Street has had buy ratings on this stock from its peak of $82 per share in 2007, the entire way on its 90% downward path to its current price. Surely they must be right this time. No. Look, come on now, let's get real here. The truly disturbing revelation from the Census Bureau data and the terrible financial results being reported by some of the biggest retailers in the world is that they're occurring with unemployment at 5.3%, the economy in the sixth year of a so-called recovery, and a Fed which has pumped $3 trillion into the banking system while still keeping interest rates at 0%? Have any of you asked the obvious question? Let me give you a hint. Let me repeat what I just said. Hey, you in the back row, wake up! All this horror that I've just described has been happening with unemployment at 5.3%. The economy in the sixth year of this stupid so-called recovery, and money thrown into the system willy-nilly at a rate of $3 trillion with 0% interest. So, the question is, what happens when we roll back into the next official recession, unemployment soars, and consumers really stop spending? No, please, I am serious, ladies and gentlemen. Please ask yourself that question. Go on, face it. It's just too grim to face, isn't it? No, I mean it. I am here to announce the most unthinkably grim times ahead. Do you get it? Have I made it clear what's going on here? Because you see, what's really revealed when you look under the hood of this economic recovery is that it is a complete and utter fraud. There is no recovery. How many times have I said this for years and years? There is no recovery. Over and over again, week after week, month after month, year after year, there is no recovery. There is no recovery. And then I get all these well-meaning expressions of awe from listeners who are telling me that I was right all along. No, I take no credit at all for being right. That's like saying 2 + 2 = 4, but nobody believes you until they do, and then they say you're a genius because you were right all along. This is not rocket science, ladies and gentlemen. If you can't detach yourselves from these frightful bimbos on TV screeching the non-news at you and the crap you read in your newspaper, then I can't help you. There's only so much I can say, and only so many times I can say it. Nah, my listener numbers aren't increasing, I'm afraid. They're staying more or less stable. I get it that my message is not a popular one. This recovery is nothing but smoke and mirrors, buoyed by subprime auto debt, Really subprime student loan debt, corporate stock buybacks and Fed-financed bubbles in stocks, real estate and bonds. The four retailers whose stats I just gave you are nothing but zombies, kept alive by the Fed's zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing, as they stumble and lurch towards their ultimate deaths. The coming depression will be the dagger plunging through their skulls, putting them out of their misery.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake-Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Well, so much for Wall Street's latest claim that the American consumer is bounding back. On an inflation-adjusted basis, retail sales are still barely higher than they were a year ago, and for that matter, are only 4% higher in real terms than they were back in November 2007. That's right, nearly 8 years and $3.5 trillion of Fed money printing later, and the vaunted American consumer is struggling to stay above the flat line, not exactly shopping up a storm. And there's no mystery as to why. After a 40-year borrowing spree culminating in the final mortgage credit blow-off on the eve of the great financial crisis, the U.S. household sector had reached peak debt. It was tapped out with $13 trillion of mortgages, credit cards, auto, student, and other loans. This is a colossal financial burden, amounting to nearly 220% of wage and salary income, or nearly triple the leverage ratio that had prevailed before 1971. So we are now in a different economic ballgame from the consumer debt binge cycle that culminated in 2008. Households are deleveraging out of necessity, and that means that consumer spending is tethered to the tepid growth of rational output and wage income. Yet sell-side economists and the financial press are so desperate for factoids that confirm the Keynesian recovery narrative, that is, the false claim that the US economy has been successfully lifted out of a growth rut by mega injections of fiscal and monetary stimulus, that they get just plain silly about Washington's seasonally maladjusted, endlessly revised monthly data squiggles. Thus, in response to the 0.6% gain in July retail sales, the Wall Street Journal's headline proclaimed, "In a show of confidence, Americans boost spending." Even that was fair and balanced compared to the typical economist's fare, opined Richard Moody of Regions Financial Corp, and I quote, "The July retail sales report should help allay any remaining concerns as to the state and psyche of U.S. consumers. U.S. consumers are just fine." End of quote. Oh, come on. The July retail sales number was barely 1% higher than it was in November 2014, and it's been up, down, and around the barn in the 9 months since then. Indeed, the signal in July's monthly noise was that the American consumer remains stranded on the sidelines and that consumption-driven escape velocity isn't going to materialize no matter how long the Fed dispenses zero or near zero cost money to the Wall Street casino. Instead of rabbiting on about the last 10 days of heavily medicated preliminary advanced retail sales data, the sell-side bulls would do well to look at the last 25 years of inflation-adjusted retail spending. The trend has drastically decelerated and, in fact, has nearly lapsed to stall speed since households hit peak debt. compared to a 3.3% annualized rate of gain in the 1990s recovery cycle, when household leverage ratios were racing upwards, and 1.9% during the 2001-2007 Greenspan housing bubble. Real sales have only grown at a 0.5% rate since the November 2007 pre-crisis peak. After 93 months, that is not a recession-induced transient dislocation. It's a deeply embedded trend. Indeed, this business expansion is already long in the tooth at 74 months, compared to a post-war average of 61 months. So given the 2%, more or less, real growth trends of the last few years, and no chance that retail spending will rebound to historic rates of over-the-cycle gain before the next recession takes its toll, this radical downshift in the trend rate of real estate retail sales surely demonstrates that the radical dose of quantitative easing and zero interest rate policy hurtled at the American consumer by the Fed has not worked. But it also points to the actual blatant deformations that it has inflicted on the financial markets in the process. The last thing you'd expect in an environment where the consumer sector is dramatically and visibly stalling is a rampage of borrowing to open new retail stores and to fund the buyback of gobs of retailer stock. But the fact is, some of the nation's largest retailers have been loading their balance sheets with cheap debt in order to buy back stock at rates which far exceed their faltering income. To illustrate the dodgy condition of the debt-strapped American consumer, Jim Quinn dissected the most recent financial results of the four largest U.S. mall retailers. Sales are flat versus the year ago. And all of these retailers are showing reduced earnings versus the last 6 years. So it just shows you how little progress is being made despite the manifestations of bullishness to the contrary by everyone else. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, I'd like to provide a reminder of the outrageous scandal of how America went to war in really false pretenses. It's easy to forget, you know, and even then, a number of younger people who probably have no idea of what happened have been sheltered from the grim truth. So I thought I would just remind you in a few words here. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush repeated one of the biggest falsehoods of our time during the recent quote-unquote "we were misled into the Iraq war by faulty intelligence" presidential candidate debate speech. U.S. intelligence was not misled. It was ordered by de facto President Dick Cheney to provide excuses for a war against Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Tony Blair forced British intelligence services to sex up reports that Iraq had nuclear weapons. He purged the governments and the venerable broadcaster BBC of journalists who failed to amplify his lies. Bush and Blair reportedly discussed painting a U.S. Air Force plane in UN colors and getting it to buzz Iraqi anti-aircraft sites in hopes the Iraqis would fire on it. Bush told Blair that after conquering Iraq, he intended to invade Iran, Syria, Libya, and Pakistan. In fact, Iraq, of course, had no weapons of mass destruction, save some rusty barrels of mustard and nerve gas that had been supplied by the US and Britain for use against Iran. The story broke in late 1990. Tyler Drumheller, who died on August the 2nd, was the former chief of CIA's European Division. He was the highest-ranking intelligence officer to go public and accuse the Bush administration of hyping fabricated evidence to justify invading Iraq. He was particularly forceful in denouncing the Iraqi defector codenamed Curveball, whose ludicrous claims about mobile Iraqi germ laboratories were trumpeted before the UN by former Secretary of State Colin Powell. Curveball's claims were outright lies, and Powell, whose career was ruined by parroting these absurd allegations, should have known better. Curveball was an agent provocateur clearly sent by a neighbour of Iraq to help promote a US attack. Whether it was Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, or Israel that sent Curveball, we still don't know. All three fabricated so-called evidence against Iraq and passed it to Washington. That's where US intelligence was indeed misled. But that's only a minor part of the story. A Washington cabal of pro-Israel neocons, oil men, and old-fashioned imperialists joined to promote a grossly illegal invasion of oil-rich Iraq. One of its senior members, former Pentagon official Paul Wolfowitz, admitted that weapons of mass destruction was chosen as the most convenient and emotive pretext for war. Orders went out to CIA and NSA to find information linking Iraq to 9/11 and weapons of mass destruction. Some of the worst torture inflicted on suspects kidnapped by CIA's action teams was designated to make them admit to a link between 9/11 and Saddam. There was, of course, none. But administration officials like Condoleezza Rice kept broadly hinting at a nuclear threat to the United States. Before the 2003 invasion of Iraq, polls showed a majority of Americans believed Iraq was threatening the US with nuclear attack and was behind 9/11. Amazingly, a poll taken of self-professed evangelical Christians just before the US attacked Iraq showed that over 80% supported war against Iraq. So much for turning the other cheek. Most of the US media, notably the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal, amplified the lies of the Bush administration. TV networks were ordered never to show American military casualties or civilian dead. Those who questioned the rationale for war or who wouldn't go along with the party line were blanked out from print and TV. For example, some were immediately dropped from major TV networks after daring to mention that Israel supported the 2003 Iraq War and would benefit from it. Some were blacklisted by other major TV networks at the direct demand of the Bush White House for repeatedly insisting that Iraq had no nuclear capability. Very few analysts, journalists, or politicians took time to ask, even if Iraq had nuclear weapons, how they could be delivered to North America. Iraq had no long-range bombers and no missiles with range greater than 100 kilometers. Perhaps by FedEx? No one asked, why would Iraq invite national suicide trying to hit the United States? The most original answer came from George W. Bush. Nefarious Iraqi freighters were lurking in the North Atlantic, carrying, quote-unquote, drones of death that would attack sleeping America. This hallucination was based on a single report that the bumbling Iraqis were working on a model airplane that in the end broke and never flew. What inspired such a phantasmagorical idea? Pot? Too much bourbon? LSD? Or thundering orders from Cheney to find a damned good excuse for invading Iraq? For Cheney and his oil pals, conquering Iraq would secure the Arab world's biggest oil reserves for Uncle Sam and offer a central military base in the region. For Washington's bloodthirsty neocons, pulverizing Iraq would remove one of Israel's most determined enemies, crush the only Arab nation that might challenge Israel's nuclear monopoly, and cost Israel nothing. Invading Iraq produced the slow disintegration of the Middle East so long sought by militant Zionists. It all worked brilliantly, at least from Israel's viewpoint. Not, however, for the US. Bush's invasion shattered Iraq, led to Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and left Washington saddled with a $1 trillion bill instead of the $60 million cost estimated by Wolfowitz. The Middle East is in a tailspin. Palestinians are isolated, and Egypt, the region's key nation, is run by an Arab fascist military dictatorship. Drumheller was the only senior CIA officer to tell Americans they were lied into an unnecessary, illegal war. Today, we have Iraqi déjà vu anew as the lie factories and fearmongers work overtime to promote war with Iran. Does this sound familiar? Quote, how many times do I have to pay for college? I had to work my way through college and grad school, although I did get some loans too. Now I'm about to have to pay for my daughter's college education. And now Hillary Clinton wants to raise my taxes to pay for the college education of kids I don't even know, who will comprise the top 50% of the richest major country in the world once they graduate, and who will enjoy a lifestyle far ahead of mine. End of quote. Well, I don't know what message there is in there for you, ladies and gentlemen, but I would say that this is a powerful message to me, that it is time to leave the United States. The person who wrote this will sadly never get ahead. Guaranteed. Well, just to make sure you understand this, let me emphasize that during the last few years we have experienced a vast increase in the supply of money and credit versus available goods and services. Remember that the intrinsic value of money is that which it covers in value, i.e., the available stock of assets. So when the number of assets remains relatively constant, but the amount of money in circulation expands to the degree it has, the consequences amount to the creation of a bubble of virtual wealth with no substance to back up the pile of corresponding loans that it rests upon. This is a bit like playing a giant game of musical chairs, where there are perhaps 7 chairs for every 100 people playing the game. When the music stops, those best positioned to understand the rules of the game will grab a chair as quickly as possible. Everyone else will be out of the game. The end game of credit expansion is always a credit implosion, where the excess claims are rapidly and messily extinguished. This is, of course, deflation by definition, a contraction in the supply of money and credit relative to available goods and services. You can see how painful this is, much more so than when the original expansion simply allowed people to borrow more money than was good for them, or that they were good for. Then they would go out and party and celebrate the arrival of the new money. The reverse is a never-ending nightmare where all the income streams of the productive economy can no longer service the debt created. And there are no more willing borrowers or lenders. The demand stimulation disappears, leaving a great deal of supply without a market. The demand that had been effectively borrowed from the future must be repaid once the bubble bursts, leading to a prolonged period of low demand. The supply that had arisen to service it no longer has a reason to exist, and, of course, cannot be maintained. The economy moves into a period of seizure under such circumstances. We will be looking at a period of acute liquidity crunch, followed by a long period of chronic financial instability. Deflation and economic depression are mutually reinforcing. Hence, once that downward spiral or vicious circle dynamic has taken hold, we will remain in its grip for many, many years. Now, don't worry if you haven't quite grasped this. It's a little bit complicated, and we will be talking about it many times again over the next few weeks. The one thing I would ask you to remember, however, is that as I have told you that the supply of money is decreasing, you must understand that it is therefore quite logical and natural that the dollar increases in value vis-a-vis other currencies, because the amount of dollars in circulation, as I've just described, diminishes. But we will talk about that again at some point. So don't fear, we will take care of it in the fullness of time. Well, here is a letter from Jim Fagiolo. Hi, Richard. I've been meaning to update you about progress with the meetup group I was planning to start here in Seattle. After a month of very little interest, I decided it wasn't worth any more of my time, which I feel would be better spent in taking care of myself. When I first heard your show a few years ago, after the first 10 minutes of listening to you, I was convinced. I didn't need all the statistics, graphs, etc. to convince me. I knew inside you were right on. Most of the people I talked to think I'm crazy. These are good people, professionals, intellectuals, what we would call good humans and good citizens. They are just conditioned from their experiences in life to believe that certain things are the way they are. Until living conditions change for the worse, their perspective won't change. 8 years ago, when Obama was first elected, I happened to be at a dinner party while the TV was on and all the guests were listening to the news for the election results. When it was announced that Obama had won, everyone held hands and many were crying with joy, as if things were going to change now. I just rolled my eyes. I suppose Shakespeare was right. The world is a stage. And I suppose we all will play our part. Most people I know will play the part of victims on American soil. Thanks again. I'm glad I found you, and the best of luck with your upcoming seminar. Wish I could be there. Warm regards, Jim. Well, thank you, Jim. Ladies and gentlemen, I do encourage you to write in. I've been having very few letters from the listeners. Do please write. The email address is rwlmartin1@gmail.com. Let me repeat that. My email address is rwlmartin1@gmail.com. And my phone number, in case you want to call me, is on a Florida, Miami area code 305-454-2707. Let me repeat that. 305-454-2707. Well, people running food banks all over America say that demand for their services just continues to explode. It always amazes me that there are still people out there that insist that an economic collapse is not happening. From their air-conditioned homes in their cushy suburban neighborhoods, they mock the idea that the U.S. economy is crumbling. But if they just went down and visited the local food banks in their areas, they would see how much people are hurting. According to Feeding America spokesman Ross Fraser, 46 million Americans got food from a food bank at least once during 2014. The demand has become so overwhelming that some food banks are cutting back on the number of days they operate and the amount of food given to each family. Many impoverished Americans are lining up at food banks as early as 6:30 in the morning so they can be sure to get something to eat before the food runs out. Yet there are still many people out there that have the audacity to say that everything is just fine in America. Poverty in America is getting worse. No amount of spin from Obama or his apologists can change that fact. This year, it's being projected that food banks in the United States will give away an all-time record £4 billion of food. Over the past decade, that number has more than doubled. That number would be even higher if food banks had more food to give away. The demand has become so crushing that some food banks have reduced the amount of food each family gets. Food banks across the country are seeing rising demand for free groceries despite the growing economy, leading some charities to reduce the amount of food they offer each family. Those in need are starting to realize what's going on, so they are getting to the food banks earlier and earlier. For example, one food bank in New Mexico is getting now long lines of people every single day, starting, as I said, at 6:30 in the morning. According to Sheila Moore, who oversees food distribution at the Stone House, the largest pantry in Albuquerque, New Mexico, quote unquote, "We get lines of people every day starting at 6:30 in the morning." Her food distribution has climbed 15% in the past year. Does that sound like an economic recovery to you? The fact that your family may not have to stand in line for food does not mean that everything's okay in America, you know. What's happening in New Mexico is also happening in Ohio. Needy people are standing in line at the crack of dawn so that they can be sure to get something before the food runs out. Lisa Hamlet Fugit, executive director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks, who has been working in food charities since the 1980s, said that when earlier economic downturns ended, food demand declined, but not this time. She said, and I quote, "People keep coming here earlier and earlier. They're standing in line, hoping that they get here before the food runs out." End of quote. Keep in mind that we're just now entering the next global financial crisis and the next major recession. Things will be incomparably bad when millions more people lose their jobs and millions more lose their homes. Rising poverty is also reflected in the number of Americans on food stamps. The number of Americans on food stamps continued to rise for years, even after the recession ended. Things are only going to get worse from here. Eventually, the kinds of things that we're seeing happen in places such as Venezuela will be coming to America as well. At this point, young mothers in Venezuela are sleeping outside empty supermarkets at night in a desperate attempt to get something for their families when morning arrives. As dawn breaks over the scorching Venezuelan city of Maracaibo, smugglers, young mothers, and a handful of kids stir outside a supermarket where they spent the night, hoping to be first in line for scarce rice, milk, or whatever may be available. Some of the people are in line, half asleep, on flattened cardboard boxes. Others are drinking coffee. Most Americans cannot identify with this level of suffering, but it's coming to America someday too. The number of Americans living in concentrated areas of high poverty has doubled since the year 2000. In case you're wondering, that is not a sign of progress. When you add increasing racial tensions to the mix, it becomes easier to understand why there is so much anger and frustration in the urban areas. According to Business Insider, the percentage of Americans that consider race relations to be in good shape in the nation has dropped precipitously. Over the last 2 years, there has been a 23% drop in the number of Americans who see relations between blacks and whites as very good or somewhat good. Today, only 47% of Americans see black and white relations positively, according to a Gallup poll, the lowest it has been in the last 14 years. The poll also showed that blacks see the relations more positively, 51%, than whites, 45%. But both percentages experienced sharp declines in the last 2 years. All the ingredients are there for civil unrest to erupt in cities all over the United States. When the next major economic downturn happens, anger and frustration are going to flare to extremely dangerous levels. At this point, it will not take much to set things off. Desperate people do desperate things, and desperation is rising even now in the country. Things got to this terrible state of affairs because stupid decisions lead to stupid results. And very soon, America is going to start to pay a very great price for decades of incredibly stupid decisions. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, that's it. That's our show for today. Have a great weekend, and I will be back, as always, on Monday, same time, same place.
And there you have it. You decide.